Baker was the daughter of Eliza and Adam Baker and had suffered from childhood cancer, to which she'd lost a lung and a leg. That's a hard enough path for any child to walk, and you may be able to stop there and question the justice and rightness of such a young child suffering such a heavy loss. But Zara Baker, with one leg and one lung, ended up in the care of her mother-in-law in the United States of America, who was a woman of unspeakable evil. She subjected her daughter-in-law to endless abuse, and the facts of the case are unrepeatable, and the little girl was eventually murdered by her mother, who was sentenced this year to 18 years in jail. And everything about that is just so wrong. Everything about that, the story of that little girl's life, her mother, her mother-in-law, and even the sentence that her mother-in-law endured, everything about that, I think, makes any sane person begin to ask questions about justice in this world. Well, for the last few weeks, we've been living with this book, this kind of strange, sometimes whimsical, sometimes depressing book, the book of Ecclesiastes, which sets up in the Bible to take us on a kind of unorthodox journey through life. He wants us to see life from a particular and somewhat minority standpoint. And we want to continue this journey with this writer on the question of justice. We've seen him on pleasure and wealth and work and life and so on. But we want to see today his kind of minority report on the question of justice in this world. And I've really just got two sections. I want to see what he sees, and then I want to go wider to see what the Bible says about what he sees. So firstly, what he sees, what the writer of Ecclesiastes, the teacher, sees. Back in chapter 4, I'll read this to you. He says this. He says, "I saw," very classic phrase for him, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And so I declare, says the teacher, that the dead who have already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is the one who has not yet been born, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. The writer looks at our world, and he looks particularly at this, the power of the oppressor and the weakness of the oppressed. And he says they have no comforter. They have no one to defend them, no one to care for them. And he says, on the basis of that observation, that quite frankly, in order of blessing, the best thing, the worst thing is to be alive. The second best thing is to have died. And the best thing, the ace of spades, the trump card, is to have never been born at all. It's not the kind of thing you find on fridge magnets or on inspirational posters of people running down mountains on mountain bikes and so on. It's not what you see on inspirational posters, but I think if you think about the Zara Baker case or the case of the oppressed who have no comforter, you can't help but think that what he says is true. That when you look at manifest evil and manifest injustice, you can't help but think that perhaps it would have been more blessed for this person to have never been born. In chapter 5 of the book, he gives this kind of worldly, weary, resigned attitude. In chapter 5, he says, "If you see the poor oppressed in a district and they're denied justice, don't be surprised at such a thing." He wants us to keep looking, to stare at the things that we don't care to stare at, and to at least acknowledge that they're there and they're real and they're everywhere. And sometimes in the book he draws our attention to those more obvious manifest situations of the oppressed and so on. But at other times he wants you to just pay attention to the just low-level white noise injustice of everyday life, perhaps some of the injustices that you've already experienced this morning. He says in chapter 9, "The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favour to the learned. But time and chance happen to them all." In Aristotle, the great philosopher, in Aristotle's understanding of justice, he includes that kind of manifest injustice that we've talked about. But he also includes something that's unusual for us, but resonant with the writer of Ecclesiastes, a kind of injustice of the inappropriateness of the allocation of resources based on giftedness. That's a complicated phrase. What I mean is this. Aristotle would say, if you were at an auction and there was a rich man and there was a talented, say, whopper student who were both bidding for an ancient and beautiful violin, then justice, according to Aristotle, says that the violin should go to the one who plays it and not to the one who can afford it. Very strange in our kind of market-driven economy. You think the guy with the most money, he obviously deserves it. Aristotle says, no, there's a kind of injustice in that. The violin should go to the one who can play it and bring it to its fullness. And that's the idea here, that as well as manifest injustice, there's just resource injustice. That I guess in the city on this day, surely there are geologists who have worked hard and diligently and are talented, but who have just never found the great deposit. And others who are less talented, who somehow happen to be in the right desert at the right time and found it. Surely in the city today there were tenders that went to people who could not do with that tender what the other company could have done. Surely in the city today there were departments in government that squandered the money that was allocated to them poorly, and there were private sector people looking at the money that was taken from the taxpayer and thought, we could have done something amazing with that. And the writer of Ecclesiastes, he just wants to say, just notice that, see it. See the big injustice and just see that low-level white noise injustice of everyday life. Notice that it happens. But if you're willing to see what he sees and notice what he notices, how can you respond to it? Now, of course, Christians aren't the first people to notice injustice and try to respond to it. There's been thousands of years of human history of people from different religions and backgrounds trying to grasp it. So I want to give you some other approaches to it, not to disparage them, but to give you a sense of what the Bible says and how different it is. See, some people have said that you see what appears to be injustice, but what appears to be injustice is in fact balance. That this is the great observation of Hinduism, for example, that what looks like injustice, the poverty of that man or the wealth of that woman or what looks like injustice is actually part of kind of an ecosystem. That the unjust treatment there is actually for past wrongs or to balance a greater justice here. And the whole universe, which seems unjust if you focus on the injustices, is actually balanced and part of an organic and balanced whole with an endless cycle of life and death and life and death and so on. And as a belief system, it's almost impossible to disprove. And actually, in terms of observation, it's got a lot going for it as you think about ecosystems and human societies, the way things die and live and die and live and so on. But one Hindu in particular was not satisfied with that answer. He was a Hindu prince who became the father of a new Hindu offshoot or rejection called Buddhism. In around the year 500 BC, a Hindu prince left his home in search of enlightenment and became the Buddha as he came to the conclusion that suffering is in fact an illusion. That injustice, which Hinduism had said was a balance, he said, in actual fact, does not exist. And in actual fact, the nature of life is that we suffer because we want. And so Buddha says, well, don't want. Don't desire that thing. Don't desire to be well, and then sickness will not confront you with suffering. Don't desire the tender, and then the tender will not annoy you, and it goes to the wrong person. It has been a belief that has shaped and helped the life of millions to cope with injustice. But it may be, on the contrary, that it's not a case of balance or it's not an illusion, but an injustice is in fact part of a determined will. This would be the belief of, say, Orthodox Islam, where Allah's total control over the world means that his ways are higher than our ways and that his activities in the world are inscrutable and all things are the will of Allah. In injustice as balance, injustice as illusion, injustice as determined. And finally, I guess the livest option for 21st century Westerners is that injustice is just natural. That it just is. And to ask the kind of questions that we're asking today is just kind of weird, given who we are and where we came from. I won't compete with a much better wordsmith than me. I'll give it to you in the words of Richard Dawkins, for whom this is his view. Dawkins puts his case on it this way. In a universe, and I quote, in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky, and we won't find any rhyme or reason for it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we just dance to its music. Now, whatever you make of that as an account of injustice, is breathtakingly consistent and honest. You can never accuse Dawkins of flinching at those realities. But he says in the end, DNA just is, we just are, and in the end, some people like Zara Baker get hurt and other people get lucky, and that's just how things roll. Well, again, I present those not to disparage them, but to try to give us a sense of how different the response of the Bible is to all of those alternatives. Time and time again in the book of Ecclesiastes, which is very minor on hope, but time and time again he talks about the fear of God, the coming judgment of God. He acknowledges that we don't know, like Dawkins, I guess, the explanation of what has happened in a particular instance. But he looks to a God who will one day bring about justice through judgment. That great Jewish hope that God would one day raise the dead, that the dead would one day stand before their Creator, and those who have suffered injustice would be vindicated, and those who have perpetrated injustice would be brought judgment. And I think if you just sit with that as an idea for a moment, even if it's not your own thought, you can see how powerful it is at least addressing that intuitive sense that with the Zara Baker, that you say that's not how it's meant to be. That there is something there that is not right, and that someone somewhere should be called to account for what happens in this world. In the story of the Bible, we don't see suffering as a balance. We don't experience injustice as an illusion. We don't read evil as it's simply the will of God. And we don't resign ourselves to suffering as a natural phenomenon. Now, if you enter into the thought world of Ecclesiastes in the Bible, we call injustice evil. One of the interesting features of Ecclesiastes and the Bible in general is how unblushing it is at asking you to look at suffering and injustice and evil. You would think that if the Bible was supposed to be God's book, commending the virtues of following God, it would kind of just say there's some problems and we're just going to sweep them under the carpet. But in actual fact, in a way that makes any modern Westerner blush, the Bible is constantly saying, no, look at this thing. Look at the injustice. Because it really is evil. It's something that is, but ought not be. You see, the Bible, Ecclesiastes and the rest of the Bible, reframes our question from not so much why, but for how much longer. If there is a just God who will one day judge the world with justice, for how much longer can injustice continue? And the Bible's answer is not forever. That one day, according to the Bible, the Christian hope is that God will bring justice to the earth. He says that God will one day vindicate the victim and judge the oppressor. That he will one day wipe every tear from our eyes and there will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. The Russian author Dostoevsky puts it this way in his great novel, The Brothers Karamazov. He says, and I quote, "I trust that the wounds will heal, that the scars will vanish, and that all the sorry and ridiculous spectacle of man's clash will disappear like a pitiful mirage, and that in the end, in the universal finale, something so magnificent will take place that it will satisfy every human heart, allay every indignation, pay for all human crime, and enable everyone, not only to forgive everything, but to justify everything that has happened. It's a kind of dizzy, almost irrational hope, isn't it? That there's very few humans who hear that and think, if that were true, it would be a good thing. My heart says yes. But maybe as your heart says yes, your head says no. Karl Marx said, in a very tender passage actually, and I quote again, that religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. It is the heart of the heartless world. It is the soul of our soulless condition. It is the opium for the people. To think that something is good doesn't make it true. And so I want to ask, as I guess as we bring this together, if what the Bible says is good, could you also believe at the same time that it is true? That one day God will bring justice to the earth? Well, the Christian gospel does have an answer to the skeptical mind. It does say something to those who want it to be true but can't believe it to be true. And the Christian answer to the skeptical mind about the great hope of a God who brings justice is a story that happened in a garden. Come with me for a couple of minutes as we go back in your imagination to a garden. Picture this, we're in a garden, it's early in the morning, it's cold because it's still dark. And a woman goes to a garden, which in fact is not really a garden, it's more like a cemetery or a graveyard. And a woman goes to that graveyard to pay respects for a loved one that's died. And she comes to a grave and she finds something that no one wants to find early in the morning when it's still dark in a cemetery. She finds that someone's been tampering with the grave. Now, I just think about that. I'm not the bravest person in the world at the best of times, but I probably wouldn't even walk through a cemetery at night time. But certainly, to go to the grave of a loved one and to find that someone's tampered with it, someone was there before you between sundown and now, would be terrifying. But she's not as scared as I am, but she starts to ask questions, and she says, what is happening here? What has gone on at this place? And so she runs back to her friends, and she says to her friends, they've taken the body, and I don't know where. And so her two friends start running for the garden, for the cemetery, and the younger one gets there first, but he doesn't go in, and he looks at the outside, and he sees that the woman's thesis holds, that the stone has been moved, but he doesn't go in. But the second guy, who's older, who gets there later, runs into the kind of tomb, and he finds that the story checks out again. There's more evidence for the hypothesis, because there is no body in the tomb. And he discovers something unusual, that on the place where the body lay, there's the grave clothes of the person that was there, and they've been folded and put, and the body's grave clothes have been put to one side, and then the thing that was around the head has been folded separately and put to the other side. What sense do you make of that scene? Just use your kind of CSI investigative skills for a moment. What do you make of that scene? The woman's right, the body wasn't there, someone's taken it. That's her conclusion. This story's from 2,000 years ago, but they're not kind of... They're as sceptical as you and I are. They don't immediately think, oh, some miracle's happened. They think, who's taken the body? And the body-taking thesis seems to hold, except for some unusual clues. So this is 2,000 years ago, where there isn't a big market for spare parts of bodies. So who's taking a body, and for what purpose? Why does someone steal the body? This is a Jewish context, and Jewish people don't steal bodies. They don't touch bodies because they make you unclean. And if you're stealing a body, what do you want to do with it? And furthermore, if you've taken a body, why do you want to take the clothes off the body before you take it out? How does it help you as a grave robber to have a naked body rather than a clothed body? So that you're running through Jerusalem, story happens in Jerusalem, you're running through Jerusalem kind of with this dead naked body, and someone comes up to you and says, Bob, what are you doing? It's really early in the morning. Bob's like, nothing. And he goes, well, why have you got a dead naked body in your hands? And certainly if someone's stolen the body and taken the clothes off, it's very unlikely that the kind of people that steal bodies are also kind of neat freaks who think, let's just fold these clothes before, put that there and that there, and just, we want the place to look just so before we run off with a dead naked body. These are the theories that are going through people's minds, but the woman is out in the garden weeping, and as she's weeping, a man comes up to her and says, why are you crying? Who is it that you're looking for? And she thinks it's the gardener, and she says, sir, if you've taken him away, tell me where you put him and I will get him. And the gardener says to her, Mary. And Mary says to him, Rabbi. That story, as you probably get somewhere on the way through, is the story from the Gospel of John about the resurrection of Jesus. He'd been killed early, he'd been buried in the tomb, and they discovered he was not there, and then they saw him living. As a piece of knowledge for the skeptical mind, it's open to investigation. It's not open to experimentation. It's not a scientific thing where if you put a body in a tomb in Jerusalem at any time and you try the same thing in Harvard with the same conditions, then you'll find that dead bodies always rise at that time of the morning under those circumstances. It's not open to experimentation, but it is open to historical investigation. These accounts speak of eyewitness things, that they remember who's younger, who's older, who got their first, who got their second, how the clothes were arranged, where they were. They have all the fingerprints of them, of an eyewitness account. But here's the question I want to come back to as we finish today. Not so much whether it happened, although that's an important question, but what does it mean? How does it answer the cry of Ecclesiastes and the cry of our hearts on the quest for justice? Well, according to the Christian gospel, what it means is that the resurrection and therefore the judgment of God has begun. That the hope of the judgment and the justice of God is now no longer a hope, it's a message, because it's already begun in Jesus. According to the Christian gospel, by raising him from the dead, God has declared that he has appointed his just king who will bring judgment and justice and end the sorry mess of a world of injustice. It's open for investigation. It's open for you to think about, to see whether it is so. But if it's so, it is very good news.